National Trust Magazine, Summer 2025.
There's something so emotive, not to mention fun, about castles and how they catch imaginations of all ages in a way few other buildings can match. Take this issue's cover star, Corfe Castle, gazing serenely over the Dorset landscape. What it must have witnessed over the centuries. Picture the lives that have played out behind its sheltering walls, the triumph and anguish of fights won and lost. Today's Corfe faces its greatest battle yet, the ravages of climate change. In our feature, Holding the Fort, you can hear about the £2 million conservation project to bolster it for the future, and find a castle to visit near you. Some creative souls, meanwhile, have been inspired by the bleak, dramatic beauty of Orford Ness in Suffolk, including Radiohead artist Stanley Donwood, author Robert McFarlane, and musician Hayden Thorpe. That's in the feature From War to Wilderness. And, bringing a completely different energy, this year's Summer of Play is sure to stir young imaginations as it returns to almost 200 trust places across the UK. Sponsored by Starling Bank, it offers a wide range of activities to enjoy over the summer holidays and plenty of fun ideas to try at home. Here's Olivia Vinall, Akia Henry and Glenn McCready to tell you about what's been happening around the Trust.
Under our wing. This August, it'll be 100 years since the Trust took Northumberland's Farne Islands into our care. We'll be celebrating the centenary with a range of events, including a special soundscape of the island and two live webcams capturing what the seabirds living there get up to. The Farnes are situated just off the coast of Northumberland, only a short boat ride away from the mainland. Threatened seabirds thrive on the rocky islands, including puffins, affectionately known as clowns of the sea. The islands opened for visitors again last spring, following a two-year period of closure due to bird flu, which hit the colony hard. Thankfully, we've since seen a 15% increase in puffin numbers, and the population has been declared stable. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/farne-islands for more information.
Paint the town green. Following a successful pilot in 2024, the National Trust's Sky Gardening Challenge launched across Greater Manchester in spring this year. The project inspires people living in flats and apartments without ready access to green space to connect more closely with nature by greening their balconies and window boxes with plants and flowers. Participants receive a balcony gardening handbook and newsletters full of tips on creating their own green urban escape, as well as the chance to enter a balcony garden competition with some exciting gardening prizes. To find out more about the Sky Gardening Challenge, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/sky-gardening-challenge.
Showing you round. Ever fancied a guided tour of a National Trust property from someone who actually lived or worked there? Enter Historyscapes, a free app that can take you on a GPS-triggered trail of one of the sites in our care, narrated by historical figures from each place. The app, created in collaboration with the University of Exeter, is inspired by research into people who lived and worked at Trust places. It's available at Saltram in Devon, where you can follow the route of carpenter Henry Stockman as he checks on his workers, at Quarry Bank in Cheshire, where the challenges of cotton mill workers are voiced by apprentice Frank Scott, and at Devil's Punch Bowl in Surrey, where broommaker George Mays takes you around in 1925. Go to historyscapes.uk to find out more and download the app.
Horsing around. As part of the Studland Bay Marine Partnership in Dorset, the Trust has been working with the University of Southampton to monitor and protect the bay's seagrass meadow and the rare seahorses living here. Volunteers and local divers are counting seahorse numbers and using facial ID to record each individual, and using boats fitted with special cameras and acoustics to map out the meadow. Seagrass meadows can store huge amounts of carbon and help to support a wealth of life, including pipefish, wrasse, ungulate rays, and rare spiny and short-snouted seahorses. Plan your visit to Studland Bay at nationaltrust.org.uk/studland-bay.
Filling your cup. In the UK, 2.5 billion single-use coffee cups are thrown away annually, or 7 million every day, or 5,000 every minute. That's why we're encouraging members to make the change to reusable cups. We're phasing out single-use cups from our cafes, instead encouraging visitors to bring their own travel cup or to sit and enjoy their hot drink in one of our ceramic mugs. Find out more at nationaltrust.org.uk/mag-bring-your-cup.
Save the date. Your 2025 annual general meeting will be held at the Steam Museum in Swindon on the 8th of November 2025. We warmly invite you to join fellow members both online and in person and get involved. The AGM is your opportunity to ask questions and contribute to debate, as well as hear from our Director General Hilary McGrady and Chair Renee Olivieri. Further information, along with details on how to vote in this year's council elections and on any resolutions, will be published in our next issue of this magazine and on our website from early September. You'll also find a link to our 2024-25 annual report from September. For more information, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/AGM.
And those were some of the highlights from the summer news. Our next feature is from the Director General. Your chance to hear from Hilary McGrady.
If, like me, you've ventured to the coast recently, or even braved a springtime dip in the sea, there's a good chance you owe it to a young geography lecturer, a band of students, and a fundraising appeal you might never have heard of. 60 years ago, Professor John Whittle teamed up with a group of students to survey the entire UK coastline, every inlet, beach and clifftop. He was concerned that the rapid increase in building and the boom in tourism after the war were putting much of our then unprotected coast at risk, and he was right. On St George's Day in 1965, the National Trust stepped up. We launched a major fundraising appeal called Enterprise Neptune, named after the Roman god of the sea, and lit beacons around the country to mark the occasion. Thousands of donations soon followed, enabling us to care for and protect swathes of the coast. Today, 780 miles, or 1,255 kilometres, of coastline are in trust care and free for the nation to enjoy. It's amazing to think what the UK coastline would look like if it hadn't been for everyone who contributed to Enterprise Neptune. In fact, the Trust's history is filled with stories of collective endeavour. Whether that's our earliest appeal to protect Derwent Water in the Lake District in 1902, or saving country houses from destruction in the 1930s. It's in that same spirit that we have launched a new campaign, this time to try to turn around the shocking decline in nature and wildlife. We're giving everyone a chance to adopt a plot of land at one of six places across the UK. For a small donation, you can help sow wildflower meadows, clean up rivers or plant trees to help turn these places into thriving supersites. Each plot of land that's adopted will add to a giant mosaic of nature-rich habitats, from Airy or Snowdonia in North Wales to Wick and Fen in Cambridgeshire. You can support somewhere like Wallington, a vast estate in Northumberland which provides a home to rare wildlife, including the white-clawed crayfish, pine marten, and even a beaver family. These species are at risk from the ravages of climate change, and Wallington has been badly affected by recent storms. But the potential for restoring nature here is enormous, and our team has big plans for the future. In 1965, people came together to protect our coastline for future generations. Now, we have the chance to do the same for nature. Bit by bit, plot by plot, we can piece back together the nation's natural environment. We would love to have you standing alongside us on this journey.
Thank you, Hilary McGrady, the Trust's Director General. From cannonballs to climate change, discover how Corfe Castle in Dorset is bringing hundreds of years of history to life and confronting its greatest foe yet. The article is written by assistant editor Amy Tinkler and is read by Glenn McCready.
It's May 1643, 9 months into the First English Civil War, and Corfe Castle in Dorset is under siege. Looking out from the castle keep perched on a hill, staunch royalist Mary Banks and her daughters can see a 600-strong mass of parliamentarian soldiers ranged throughout the village and valley below. Day and night the soldiers' voices and the smell of their watchfires on the surrounding hills travel on the breeze to the women and the small garrison of 80 men from the village, barricaded inside the castle. Fast forward to the present day, and Corfe Castle is besieged by a much subtler foe, climate change. Over the last decade, changing weather patterns have caused the centuries-old remains of the castle to deteriorate more rapidly than ever before, putting the entire structure at risk. In 2023, the National Trust launched a 3-year, £2 million conservation project to tackle these issues and bolster Corfe Castle's defences for the future, while also offering visitors the chance to step back in time and explore medieval life, including some mysteries from the castle's past. Standing among the ruins of the outer bailey today, you can still feel the history contained in the castle walls. James Broomfield, one of three storytellers, so called as their role is to bring Corfe Castle's history to life for visitors, says, "Back in the medieval period, this part of the castle would have been rammed with people. You'd have blacksmiths forging weapons and horseshoes, carpenters and masons working on building and repairs, people cooking food, horses and carts coming and going, soldiers practicing archery and sword fighting. It would have been noisy, smelly, and ankle-deep in mud, among other substances. If, however, you were important enough to pass through the southwest gatehouse into the castle's upper wards, you would find yourself in surroundings fit for a king." James says, "Like most early Norman castles commissioned by William the Conqueror, Corfe was originally made out of wood. However, it was later rebuilt in stone by William's son, Henry I. We know that Corfe was a key strategic location for England's monarchs as they continued to improve its defences, not to mention creating luxurious royal residences for themselves within the castle walls. The Normans were highly skilled castle builders," explains James, indicating an exposed section of the 2-metre or 6.5-foot thick curtain wall made up of two layers of facing stones, known as ashlar, sandwiching a core of rubble, all held together with lime mortar. He says, "This construction gives the walls incredible strength and makes them very durable, unless you blow them up and expose the core to the UK weather." Unfortunately for Corfe Castle, this was exactly what happened. Cast your mind back to that scene in 1643. James says, "Mary was in charge of the castle while her husband John was away with King Charles I, so the parliamentarians probably didn't expect much resistance. But when they demanded that she surrender, she fired a cannon at them. The resulting siege lasted 6 weeks, but Mary held out. According to historical accounts, she and her daughters even joined the fighting when the parliamentarians attempted to scale the walls, filling buckets with hot embers and tipping them over the soldiers below." James says, "Eventually the parliamentarians fled in the face of a royalist army advancing from the west, and Mary became a celebrity in royalist circles for her spirited defence of the castle. Yet, just 3 short years later, Corfe Castle found itself besieged once more, and this time the outcome was very different." James says, "By 1646, the Roundheads were winning the war, and Corfe was the last royalist holdout in Dorset. Parliament wanted to snuff it out, so they began another siege. Mary wasn't here this time, and John had died 2 years earlier. Morale quickly ran low. Inside the castle was one Lieutenant Colonel Pitman, who suggested that he could sneak out through a secret cellarport a small gateway, and ride to fetch reinforcements. When he returned, he brought about 120 troops, who filed in through that same Salaport. It wasn't until most of them were inside that the castle's defenders realized they were actually parliamentarians. Pitman's betrayal meant the garrison was soon defeated, and just days later, Parliament ordered the castle to be demolished. The task fell to a regiment of military engineers, known as sappers, but the castle's construction was so strong that it took 6 months to reduce it to a ruin. At one point, they ran out of gunpowder and taxed the locals to buy more. What remains today still looks impressive, but the ruins are vulnerable to our changing climate. Increased rainfall and warmer winters have accelerated the growth of vegetation, particularly valerian and ivy, whose roots grow into the cracks between the stones and weaken the lime mortar. Water seeping into the rubble core also causes damage when it freezes and expands. Periods of extreme heat are likewise problematic, as became clear during the drought in 2022. James says, as well as causing the plant roots to shrivel, the heat caused the lime mortar to dry out and shrink. This loosened the stones and quite a few fell. We collected them to put back during our big conservation project. The 3-year project primarily involves removing vegetation, carrying out repairs, and repointing the mortar of the castle's 9 towers, the central keep, and the 8-metre or 26-foot high curtain wall. Due to the castle's defensive position at the top of a steep hill, the Trust needed to bring in specialist masons with rope access training, who often carry out their work while dangling 55 metres or 180 feet or more above the valley floor. Rather than trying to restore the castle, conservators are carrying out what's known as remedial conservation to repair and stabilise structures using historic techniques and materials. Pam White, who trained in buildings and stonework conservation before working as Corfe Castle's education officer for almost 30 years, now volunteers with the Trust's Heritage and Archaeology Ranger Team, known as HART. She was part of the team responsible for sampling and analysing the lime mortars used by the original builders, and she says these days we simply lack the familiarity the Normans had with the materials. She explains, "It takes a lot of research and experimenting to get it right. The castle went up in stages, and the analysis showed that different types of lime mortar were used at different times across the castle. We've mimicked the colours and textures of the originals by developing several different mortar recipes, using varying ratios of ingredients and types of aggregates sourced from across the Purbeck area, just as the Normans did all those centuries ago. The conservators also use modern techniques to help protect the castle from the effects of climate change. Walking around today, you might spot cut turf covering the exposed tops of some of the walls. Unlike the valerian and ivy, the turf has been placed there deliberately as part of a conservation technique called soft capping." Pam explains, "When it rains, the turf absorbs the water and stops it seeping into the exposed masonry core below. Then, when the sun comes out, the grass releases the water back into the atmosphere. It's a great way of protecting the masonry while still keeping the spirit of the ruin." While the conservation teams are dealing with the lasting effects of the Civil War damage, Trust archaeologists have taken the opportunity to try to solve the mystery of where the parliamentarians entered the castle on that fateful day in 1646. Contemporary letters suggest that the Salaport Colonel Pitman used for his betrayal led directly into the inner ward, which meant the parliamentarians would have quickly been able to take possession of key areas. In 2024, the archaeologists received permission from Historic England to partially excavate an area near the remains of the East Turret, where conservation work had unexpectedly uncovered the top of a stone arch. The 2-day excavation was led by regional archaeologist Martin Papworth, who began his career with the Trust at Corfe Castle in 1986 and wanted to investigate the arch as his last dig before retiring. He says, "We had permission to lower the ground surface under the arch by half a metre, or 1.6 feet, and it quickly became clear the arch was indeed the top of a cellarport in the inner ward wall, one that isn't on any of our existing historic maps." However, the archaeologists haven't yet been able to find a corresponding exit on the outside of the wall. Martin says, "We aren't yet sure if the turret was built to block the external entrance to the cellarport, in which case it couldn't have been used to betray the castle during the Civil War, or if the turret was built as fortification for the cellarport, in which case it could. To know for sure, we'd need to dig deeper on the outside of the castle to see if there's an external entrance. In the meantime, budding archaeologists can dig into the excavation when it features in Series 3 of the BBC's Hidden Treasures of the National Trust. Corfe Castle is also hosting events as part of the Council for British Archaeology's annual Festival of Archaeology on the 18th to the 19th of July. While the castle might not be quite ready to give up the secret of its cellarport just yet, there are many other stories brought to life today, from tours guided by storytellers like James to living history events. This summer, you'll be able to learn how medieval swords were made and practice skills at arms on the 5th to the 6th of July, or witness a dramatic reenactment of the castle's last stand against the Roundheads on the 6th to the 7th of September. You can even examine the castle's replica trebuchet, which is designed to throw water balloons rather than huge rocks, burning tar barrels, dung, beehives, or any of the other missiles used in the medieval period. There's also an audio guide where characters from the castle's history share their stories. You might meet Constable Alan de Plouquinet, who managed the castle on behalf of Henry III, or hear Lady Elizabeth Hatton describing the 17th century gardens she created here. There's also the tale of Princess Eleanor of Brittany, imprisoned at the castle by her uncle, King John, after he did away with her brother Arthur and threw 22 knights sworn to protect her into the castle's oubliette, the Boutevant Tower in the West Bailey. Oublier is French for to forget, so you can imagine what happened to them. This year, Corfe Castle's visitors have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to explore a part of the castle that's usually well out of reach. The King's View is a temporary platform set high in the keep, which was commissioned by King Henry I in the early 12th century. James says, "This is where his private chambers were, so you'll see the same view that he would have enjoyed when he stayed." While the medieval period can often seem far removed from our lives, there's something about Corfe Castle that instantly transports you back to a time of chivalrous knights and siege warfare. Pam says, "I love watching people, especially young children, walk across the bridge and stop and stare at the castle looming above them. Even as a ruin, it's got so many stories to tell, and so many secrets for us still to uncover."
Visitors to Corfe Castle can climb the King's View Tower as a standalone experience or as part of a guided tour. See the website for dates and prices. All money raised goes directly towards the conservation project. Find out more or donate to the appeal at nationaltrust.org.uk/Corfe-Castle-Project. Other castles to explore near you include
Bodiam Castle in East Sussex. Bodiam has everything you'd expect from a 14th century castle, including battlements, a portcullis, and a moat. Dig into the dressing up box to see what you'd look like as a knight, or discover more about the medieval way of life during one of Bodiam's living history weekends.
Lindisfarne Castle in Northumberland. Around 750 years after the Vikings invaded Lindisfarne, Henry VIII ordered that the island be fortified as a defence against the Scots. The castle saw action during the Jacobite Rebellion and served as a garrison until architect Edwin Lutyens turned it into a holiday home in 1902.
St. Michael's Mount in Cornwall. Perched high on a rocky tidal island, the 12th century castle at St. Michael's Mount has seen its fair share of battles. It weathered the Wars of the Roses and the English Civil War and lit beacons to warn of the approaching Spanish Armada. Book at stmichaelsmount.co.uk.
To find more castles or forts near you, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/visit/castles-forts. As Season 3 of the BBC's Hidden Treasures of the National Trust airs this summer, we take a look at three of the recently conserved pieces explored in the series and ponder what they reveal about the extraordinary people who once owned them. The article is written by assistant editors Karen Gregory and Sophie Kershaw.
Beatrix Potter's Doll's House. Late last year, a team of specialist conservators undertook a spring cleaning project on an impressive scale. No room was left untouched. They repaired torn wallpaper and carpets, lifted the vinyl flooring, mended and polished every piece of furniture, and dry-cleaned the silk cushion covers. The owners of the home given such treatment? Beatrix Potter's Dolls. When children's author Beatrix Potter bought Hilltop Farm in the Lake District in 1905, using the royalties from her first illustrated books, she set about creating a sanctuary filled with her favourite things. Property curator Katie Canales says, "Hilltop is a reflection of Beatrix and her personality. It was a step change from her opulent home in South Kensington, and she took pride in filling her home with locally made historic pieces. She bought antique furniture at auctions and chose William Morris wallpaper, channeling the colours of the Cumbrian landscape in her choices. Of all the lovely items in Hilltop's collection, the one which enchants our visitors and volunteers the most is her doll's house." While Beatrix acquired the doll's house herself in the 1930s, the tiny objects inside were given to her some years earlier by her publisher and first fiancé, Norman Warne, who died before they could marry. Katie says, "The doll's house was of great sentimental value to Beatrix, as several of the objects inside were gifted by Norman specifically to inspire her illustrations in The Tale of Two Bad Mice, which was published in 1904. The house's contents include a birdcage, bellows, and the tiny glazed ham that the bad mice Hunca Munca and Tom Thumb tried to eat before discovering it is still attached to the plate. Beatrix wrote in one of her letters to Norman, "The things will do beautifully. The ham's appearance is enough to cause indigestion." Over the years, the doll's house became a treasured possession in Beatrix's home. It was particularly beloved by the children who visited her. Katie says, "It was regularly played with, as the wear and tear of the doll's house before it was conserved showed. We even found tiny letters written by children hidden in the back of the doll's house grandfather clock." The conservation project took 300 hours of work, spread across the Trust's two studios, the Royal Oak Foundation Conservation Studio at Knowle in Kent and the Textile Conservation Studio in Norfolk. Now the doll's house has returned to Hilltop and is beautifully lit in an interactive display case which visitors can control. The doll's house is the centrepiece of a new exhibit celebrating The Tale of the Two Bad Mice, and there's also a replica for little visitors to play with and enjoy. Katie says, "One of our volunteers has even created a suite of felted mice for our Mischief in Miniature trail, which we've hidden in the nooks and crannies around Hilltop for visitors to spot."
If you'd like to find out more about Beatrix Potter and the newly restored doll's house, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/hill-top.
La Bacelli statue at Knowle in Kent. The origins of this 18th century plaster statue read like the plot of a historic romance novel. In 1774, Italian ballerina Giovanna Zanarini, better known by her stage name La Bacelli, made her English debut dancing as the Rose in Le Ballet des Fleurs at the King's Theatre in Haymarket, London. Her performance caught the eye of wealthy bachelor John Frederick Sackville, who had recently inherited the title of 3rd Duke of Dorset from his uncle, along with his ancestral family home of Knowle in Kent. Their relationship flourished. In 1778, Giovanna and John Frederick had a son together, and a year later the two of them had taken up residence at Knowle. Giovanna lived a life of luxury and had agency over her own staff and servants. She had a tower of her own, which is known as Shelley's Tower, thought perhaps to be a mispronunciation of La Bacelli by the Knowle staff. Property curator Eleanor Black says, "There are plenty of references to Giovanna in the remaining Sackville family accounts. She was well supported by John Frederick. We have accounts that reference her laundry bills, as well as toys, pocket money, and cricket stumps for their son, also named John Frederick." John Frederick commissioned two of his favourite contemporary painters, Thomas Gainsborough and Joshua Reynolds, to paint portraits of Giovanna, both of which were originally displayed at Knowle. However, perhaps the most enduring legacy of their love affair was the La Bacelli plaster sculpture of her by Giovanni Battista Locatelli in 1778. The statue itself is elegant and poised, similar in style to classical marble sculptures of the goddess Venus. It shows Giovanna reclining nude across a mountain of pillows and gazing seductively across her shoulder. Eleanor says Giovanna would have needed to pose for the sculpture, and the power dynamic of that is very interesting. We'll never know if she was happy to pose for it or whether she felt exposed. When Giovanna and John Frederick's relationship ended in 1789, John Frederick settled into a respectable marriage to heiress Arabella Cope. A 1799 Knowle inventory details that Arabella requested the statue of her husband's former mistress be moved to a more discreet position in the house, and it was later renamed a Naked Venus, in the process stripping away all reference to Giovanna. Eleanor says, until fairly recently, Giovanna's, La Bacelli's, story had faded into Knowle's past. That's why we have chosen to conserve her sculpture now, to ensure that Giovanna is no longer classified just as John Frederick's mistress, but an important woman who is part of Knowle's history. She was a talented artist and clearly someone who knew how to move through society and build her own power and agency. Conservators spent 3 weeks repairing cracks and damage to La Bacelli's plaster form and cleaning away historic dirt and mould residue. She now sits along the main visitor route through Knowle, where historically she would have been displayed.
And if you'd like to see Giovanna's sculpture at Knowle in Kent, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/Knowle.
Thomas Carlyle's coat, Carlyle's house in London. Carlyle's camel hair housecoat was made in Afghanistan and given to him in 1860 by Sir Lewis Pelly, a government agent and admirer of Carlyle's work. Cultural heritage curator Eleanor Harding says, according to Pelly's account, in 1860 he was travelling from Iran to India as part of a diplomatic mission. One evening he was sleeping outside near the walls of Herat, and despite being in what he felt was a dangerous situation, he found himself unaccountably calm and happy. He put this down to his reading of Carlyle's works, likely those on the importance of fortitude in leaders. The next morning, he went to a bazaar, purchased the coat, and sent it on to Carlyle. It was later tailored in a Western style to fit Carlyle, who appears to have been grateful for the gift, as he is pictured wearing it in his house in several portraits. Scottish-born Thomas Carlyle, 1795 to 1881, was a leading figure in 19th-century intellectual life. A writer, historian, and essayist, he cemented his reputation with the three-volume The French Revolution, A History. He was widely considered a genius and often known as the Sage of Chelsea. The most celebrated writers, philosophers, and politicians of his day, from Dickens and Darwin to George Eliot and John Stuart Mill, sought invitations to his soirees and gatherings, hosted by his wife, Jane Welsh Carlyle, in their rented Victorian townhouse at 24 Cheney Row, Chelsea. Despite Carlyle's celebrity status, surviving texts suggest that he was also bad-tempered, prone to long haranguing monologues, and held deeply divisive views. Contemporaries often disagreed with him, not least with his views on race and slavery. His publication of The Occasional Discourse on the Negro Question in 1849, for example, was rejected by many of his peers and caused a break with philosopher and economist John Stuart Mill. Eleanor says, "He had the ear of all sorts of influential people. He is credited as one of the three founders of the National Portrait Gallery. And through his ideas, such as the great man theory, the idea that history is driven by the actions of a few heroic leaders born with innate qualities, he came to be seen as a sort of prophet-like figure. Whatever he was saying had a huge impact and resonance, even if people disagreed." After his death, the house at Cheyne Row was purchased by a group of admirers and maintained as a museum before coming into the Trust's care in 1936. Today, it retains many of its original furnishings, including his writing desk, the curtains sewed by Jane, and a screen she made. Following conservation and work to protect it from moth damage, Carlyle's coat is displayed in the drawing room for the first time. Eleanor says, "I hope it will give visitors a sense of who Carlyle was and what life was like for him in later years."
For more information about Thomas Carlyle's coat or Carlyle's house in London, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/Carlyle's-house. And catch season 3 of Hidden Treasures of the National Trust on BBC Two and BBC iPlayer this summer. For more information and to find out about previous series, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/hidden-treasures. From war to wilderness. Once a top-secret military testing ground, Orford Ness is now a sanctuary for wildlife and a fertile ground for artists, musicians and writers. This article is written by Deputy Editor Freya Parr and read by Akia Henry.
On a clear day, if you're standing on the shingle spit of Orford Ness in Suffolk, you can see ferries crossing to the Netherlands. But not today. Today, the Dutch coast lies invisible behind a thick curtain of fog. Only a refracted sound of a nearby tractor or dog's bark caught on the wind emerging from the wall of white. Otherwise, the silence is as total and blank as the surrounding landscape. Generations of Orford residents have referred to the Ness as the Island of Secrets. Today, the ruins of the pagodas, radar station and crumbling buildings that made up the secret Ministry of Defence military testing site form a stark contrast to the chocolate box Suffolk village on the mainland, just a short boat ride away. 1 mile wide at its largest point and about 10 miles, 16 kilometres long, the Ness is a dynamic site, constantly shape-shifting thanks to tidal currents. The tapestry of lagoons, reed beds and grazing areas forms a rich habitat for wading birds, continuing the Ness's evolution from a former First World War airfield through a Second World War testing site for bombs, ballistics and aerodynamics to the scene of Cold War secrets. These days, it's an internationally important nature reserve, where hares, Chinese water deer, wetland birds, barn owls and even seals flourish. Operations manager Glenn Pierce says, "There's plenty we still don't fully know or understand about the history here. Information is typically released under the Official Secrets Act after 30 years, but some documents have been reclassified. We learn a lot from volunteers and visitors who worked here during the Cold War, and we're capturing and archiving those memories." For much of the 20th century, Ness was a protected ecosystem, its wildlife peacefully coexisting alongside the bangs and crashes from the testing laboratories. In the years since military testing ceased, nature has flourished. When the Trust opened the site to the public in 1995, human disturbance continued to be restricted, with only a small number of visitors arriving by boat. When visitor numbers fell still further during the pandemic, 200 grey seals arrived, and the next year they started breeding. Ness is now home to about 400 seals. Glenn says, if that curve continues, we could be looking at thousands in years to come. Historic England has granted Scheduled Monument or SM status to several buildings on Orford Ness, leading the Trust to adopt a policy of curated decay for many structures on site. Glenn explains, the former AWRE, Atomic Weapons Research Establishment Laboratories, were given SM status based on their already derelict condition. The vibration test buildings, or pagodas, have been so affected by the salt water, exposed location and brutal weather that their erosion is inevitable. We maintain them as ruins with minimal intervention. Where we've got a use for a building, we maintain it, but most were only designed to have a short lifespan of a few years. It's a miracle they're still standing. The paradox of this wild post-industrial landscape has inspired dozens of writers, artists, and musicians. In recent years, three have come together to create something unique. Author Robert McFarlane's 2019 fable, Ness, blends prose and poetry to transform the landscape into a living, breathing being. He collaborated with Radiohead artist Stanley Donwood, whose ink drawings feature throughout the book. The book and its artworks have inspired Hayden Thorpe's new album, Ness, which you heard a clip of at the beginning. Released last September, it's a pulsating blend of human and mechanical textures with percussive sounds of thistles, seeds and grasses collected from the Ness. Hayden and Robert have recently performed their works together, including a series of performances on the Ness itself, with one of the decommissioned nuclear weapons in the room.
Orford Ness is open from the 5th of April to the 26th of October this year and can only be accessed by the National Trust ferry. Tickets are limited and can be booked online. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/Orford-Ness. While Bath Assembly Rooms in Somerset ready themselves for restoration, Inclusive Histories curator Tim Moore takes a trip back in time to multicultural Georgian Bath, when the Assembly Rooms were the country's most fashionable venue. It's read by Glenn MacCready.
The year is 1789. In London, pens scratch out early petitions for the abolition of slavery. In the Caribbean, whips crack out over plantations. But in Bath, a lone 11-year-old lifts his violin, letting his music speak louder than either words or force. It's hard to say exactly when George Bridgetower first arrived in England with his violin, or quite what his heritage was. His father claimed to be an African prince, but it's now thought he was from Barbados. But one thing for certain is that George's first concert at Bath Assembly Rooms in December 1789 would change his life forever. Almost overnight, George became an instant celebrity, his musical genius making him the darling of Bath. Relishing the fame and success, George and his father promenaded daily through the city, greeting their fans while wearing costumes of turbans and foreign robes. After selling out a string of shows at the Assembly Rooms, George soon earned international fame, performing across Europe alongside such luminaries as Beethoven and Haydn. George was by no means the first black celebrity in the UK, but he was certainly the first to be launched to stardom by Bath Assembly Rooms, a Grade I listed building at the heart of the UNESCO World Heritage City of Bath in Somerset. Bath's hot springs had transformed the city from a Roman spa town to a Georgian wellness retreat, and the city's assembly rooms made it the most fashionable resort in the kingdom. In 18th and 19th century Britain, assembly rooms were popular social hubs where people came together to mingle and enjoy music, dancing, conversation, and games. They were designed to impress and often had elegant ballrooms, tea rooms, and card rooms. Bath Assembly Rooms, built between 1769 and 1771 by John Wood the Younger, remain one of the largest and most significant surviving examples in England. As Inclusive Histories curator at Bath Assembly Rooms and a person of colour myself, stories like George's fascinate me. During the 2 years that I've been working with the National Trust, one of my research focuses has been searching for evidence of the other people of colour connected with George and Bath. Located between Bristol and London, two of Britain's busiest port cities, Bath was an international city which welcomed visitors from around the world. So, were there many people of colour living in George and Bath? And did any of them attend assembly room balls? George was lauded when he visited the building, but he was clearly an exceptional individual. I wanted to understand more about the experience of other people of colour connected to Bath Assembly Rooms. Through my research, I've discovered a lively presence of people of colour in George and Bath. Thanks to the city's small size, its disproportionately wealthy residents, and its fashionable obsession with keeping black servants and companions as status symbols, Bath had one of the highest ratios of black to white people in the whole country. The treatment of servants and companions varied, but the more pampered, educated, and elegantly dressed they appeared to the world, the better they reflected on their patron. So many enjoyed a comfortable lifestyle. In 1777, one writer even complained about how much better the black servants of Bath were treated than their white contemporaries. Take, for example, the painting The Black Boy by Bath artist William Jones, circa 1764 to 82, which hangs in Bath's Victoria Art Gallery. The boy, thought to have been one of Bath's domestic workers of colour at the city's famous pump rooms, looks happy, healthy, and is dressed in sumptuous clothing. Far from whitewashing his subject, the artist seems to be celebrating the boy's otherness and difference. He sits for the portrait in almost exaggeratedly foreign clothing and carries a basket of tropical fruit. Yet servants weren't the only people of colour living and working in the city. As a fashionable spa town, Bath depended heavily on visitors and attracted lots of workers and residents from communities of colour. Many were previous soldiers or sailors who had gone on to have families. The British Army and Navy offered freedom for enslaved people who joined their cause, but then often discharged them after the cessation of conflict to find work of their own. This ever-growing black population finding new work in Britain included farmers, teachers, innkeepers, musicians, preachers, and many other professions. There were black churches, black pubs, and black businesses all across the country. In London, there were even black-only concerts and balls, as well as, reportedly, a black brothel. What about people in Bath? Many were day labourers, footmen, and chairmen, who carried passengers around in sedan chairs or pushed them in Bath chairs, a bit like modern-day taxi drivers. Others, such as the portraitist William Hamlet and his family, were ordinary residents of the city, working in artisanal trades or other mercantile professions. Some were exceedingly wealthy and mixed in the highest circles of society. Nathaniel Wells, for instance, was the son of a white plantation owner and a black enslaved worker. Sent to England to be educated as a gentleman, Wells was just 15 when he inherited his father's 3 sugar plantations in St. Kitts in the West Indies, along with a fortune equivalent to roughly £13 million today. He lived at 9 Park Street in Bath and loved going to assembly room balls until he and his wife could afford to host their own at their lavish family estates. There were women of colour in Bath too, though far fewer than men. This was not unusual. Like the rest of Britain, many free people of colour were men who had arrived through military discharge. As a result, interracial relationships between men of colour and white women became increasingly common. For instance, while Nathaniel Wells was noted to have sons who looked brown and dark like their father, observers noted that his daughter had fair skin like her mother. The experience of women of colour in the city seems to have been fairly similar to the experience of the white working women of the city, with most living quiet lives, either supporting their families or employed in domestic service. George Bridgetower, meanwhile, was not the only black celebrity who visited the city. As a fashionable society hub, Bath attracted many contemporary famous celebrities of colour. Society figures like the abolitionists Ignatius Sancho and Alauda Equiano, as well as actor Ira Aldridge, all visited Bath during its heyday in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. These high-profile visitors would have witnessed Bath society at its most vibrant and also its most unruly. While the city was known for its refinement, its world-famous balls were not the elegant, ordered affairs that period dramas would have us believe. In reality, assemblies, as they were known, were hot, sweaty, smelly, and chaotic. People fought, quite literally, over space and food, and tempers could run so high that weapons were banned for fear of duels. In Jane Austen's novels, Northanger Abbey and Persuasion, both published in 1817, the Bath assemblies were mainly defined by being crowded and exceedingly hot. Novelist Tobias Smollett complained in 1771 that the smell arising from the perspiration of all these human bodies crowded together in a hot room and warmed with continual exercise contributed to compose a most intolerable stench, almost as bad as that of a jail or a hospital. On busy nights, there were over 1,200 visitors to the assembly room balls, and even in a city famous for its baths, the Georgians were not known for their standards of hygiene. Yet, for all the discomfort, Bath's assemblies remained hugely popular. When they opened, their affordability and open-door policy meant they attracted a diverse crowd, bringing together people from different backgrounds, including the city's population of people of colour. This was no accident. The designer of Bath Assembly Rooms, John Wood the Younger, intended them to be a place for events for all, a cultural melting pot of humanity from all walks of life. He shaped the building according to the ideas of his father, John Wood the Elder, who envisioned a completely new space in which rank could be laid aside and all degrees of people united in society with one another. As a consequence, anyone and everyone came to the new or upper assembly rooms when they opened. "Everyone mixes in the rooms upon an equality," said the new Bath Guide in 1784. It might have been an equitable space, but it was no idyll. My research has also thrown up some more sobering finds, such as the links between Bath assembly rooms and the slave trade. The building itself was funded through subscription, a system similar to crowdfunding, where over 60 subscribers clubbed together to fund the construction of the rooms. The group included men and women of a wide range of ages, backgrounds, and social statuses, from working residents of the city to rich visiting aristocrats. At least 8 had connections to colonial endeavours in the East or West Indies, including 4 who were either first-hand owners of or gained direct profit from the labour or trade of enslaved workers on Caribbean plantations. One of these was Jane Austen's uncle, James Lee Perrot, who was directly involved in the management of Bath Assembly Rooms. The rooms became an abolitionist hub shortly after Lee Perrot's death. George Bridgetower's violin may have soared over the chaos of the ballroom, but over the years, a far more complex story has unfolded. From dazzling balls to heated debates, from exclusion to inclusion, Bath Assembly Rooms have witnessed it all. As the National Trust restores the building for a new generation, we must ensure that stories of music, power, resistance, and change are not just preserved, but heard. The grandeur, the contradictions, and the forgotten voices each have a place in the stories we all share.
Bath Assembly Rooms are closed while undergoing restoration to bring their history back to life. As well as installing a new, grand, Georgian-inspired modern staircase, we'll be making the building more accessible with new infrastructure and conserving exquisite collections such as the 10 original chandeliers. We'll also be reducing the carbon footprint of the building by installing a new electricity substation and air source heat pumps. We're expecting to reopen Bath Assembly Rooms in 2027, when we'll reveal exciting new ways for visitors to explore stories of Georgian social life. Please consider donating to help light up Bath Assembly Rooms once again. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/assembly-rooms-project. Balancing Act. Right tree, right place. Each issue we take a look into an area of nature, beauty or history where the Trust has an interest. We curate discussion among experts with a range of views and explain the Trust's approach. In this issue, we dig deeper into the Trust's goal to establish 20 million trees by 2030. But how and where do we choose to plant and create woodland? It's a delicate balance. This article is read by Olivia Vinnell.
At Lunt, on the northern fringes of Liverpool, Luke Barley gazes across the National Trust's new 78-hectare or 192-acre wood and smiles. The trees planted last winter are barely waist-high and they stretch as far as the eye can see. Luke, the Trust's senior trees and woodland consultant, says, "We're looking at 93,000 saplings here. That represents a fairly small step towards our broader UK targets, but for the communities who live here, it's huge. They have a new nature reserve to explore, and in time, the forest will bring beauty, birdsong, and well-being benefits. It's amazing to see projects like this take root." The Trust aims to plant or establish a total of 20 million trees this decade, part of a mammoth effort to tackle climate change, stem biodiversity loss, and meet a pledge to be carbon neutral by 2030. Luke helps lead this ambitious project and admits it is a challenge. He says, "This must be the biggest land use change the Trust has ever undertaken. We've urged our estate teams to be bold and add trees wherever they can, but it's not simple. Our sites are intricate, studded with wildlife habitats, and rich in cultural significance. It's essential that we enhance the story of our places, and we're learning as we go. Planting trees isn't just digging a hole and sticking in a sapling." From the impact on tenant farmers to the protection of habitats, potential underground heritage and ground nesting birds, the Trust has a broad range of considerations affecting tree planting. Against the backdrop of a changing climate, it's more difficult than ever to plant and establish trees successfully. After the scorching summer drought of 2020, thousands of young trees planted by the government-owned road building company, National Highways, perished due to water shortages, including a reported 45% of the 860,000 planted along the A14 between Huntingdon and Cambridge. But while the race against climate change is critically important, it's also necessary to allow time for thorough site surveys so as not to damage existing landscapes. At Berrier End Farm in Cumbria in 2021, the Forestry Commission mistakenly funded a conifer plantation on valuable peatland, threatening species-rich grassland and blanket bog. Oversights in projects of this scale will happen, so ever-evolving guidance exists to help mitigate against impact on landscapes. Luke and his colleagues have written their own guidance for trust teams, but they also follow the tenets of the Woodland Trust's Woodland Creation Guide. Luke says, "There are five stages that require detailed thought, from initial vision through site assessment, design, initiation, and establishment. But the success of schemes also boils down to a 7-word mantra, the right tree in the right place." As early as 2019, ecologist Alex Morse warned against planting too many of the same kind of trees in one area. She wrote in The Independent, "One of the biggest threats to what remains of our dilapidated wildlife heritage is a loss of genetic diversity in favour of monocultures of unnaturally grown nursery trees." Luke concurs. Traditionally, he says, new native woods consisted of uniform rows of a few common tree species, perhaps oak, ash, birch, and hazel. But the one-size-fits-all approach has limited value for wildlife and is vulnerable to pests and disease. He says, "We do things differently these days. First, we rule out sites where woodland would damage valuable existing habitats, like wildflower meadows or peat moorlands, which store carbon and are rich in delicate flora themselves. Then we consider the treescape. Do we want to achieve dense traditional woodland or more open wood pasture with bigger glades and grazing animals? We're increasingly planting areas of shrubby species with just a few larger trees, or even allowing trees to set seed and colonize by themselves. Woods designed in this way typically feel more naturalistic and can kickstart the ecosystem for nesting birds such as blackcaps, wheatears, and nightingales." At Wimpole Estate in Cambridgeshire, the Trust's approach is in full swing. Spanning 3.8 square miles, or 10 square kilometres, of ancestral parkland, woods, and arable farms, Wimpole has become home to 86,000 saplings of around 28 different species. The scheme includes 48 hectares, or 120 acres, of alley cropping, where long lines of apple and elder trees pinstripe the existing wheat fields. Over time, this pioneering work should improve the soil, curtail water runoff, and extend the habitat of one of Britain's rarest mammals, the barbastelle bat, not to mention boosting the estate's annual carbon capture from 1,250 to 4,471 tonnes a year, taking Wimpole well beyond net zero. Luke also believes that by increasing overall farm yields with its new apple crop, Wimpole will help demonstrate that creating woodland and maintaining the UK's food security are not mutually exclusive. He says, "The UK's countryside has enough space to add lots more trees without threatening agricultural productivity, and, with thought, can even do the reverse." For Wimpole's farm and countryside manager, Dave Hassel, there are plenty of considerations when deciding where to plant trees. He explains, "We analysed every crop field to assess which areas were too shady or too wet to be properly productive. Those are where we've put the trees." There's an added layer of complexity at play for the Trust, the need to honour the history of a landscape and the aesthetic qualities that have endeared Wimpole to generations of visitors. In response, Dave's team brought together many voices, including curators, historians, ecologists, farm tenants, and a landscape designer. He says, "Our planting map highlighted 152 sensitive views across our historic Capability Brown Parkland, which all had to be preserved." The challenges didn't stop there. He adds, "The estate has been home to communities for thousands of years, and we knew that planting trees would prevent us learning about these people and potentially damage what they left behind." Dave's team worked with specialist archaeologists to complete surveys that sense tiny differences in the Earth's magnetic field to produce a map of what was once below the soil. He says, "The investigations mean we now know much more than before about Wimpole's prehistoric past, and they were an important part of securing consent for the work to go ahead. We commissioned several ecological surveys too, and another field was discounted when we discovered corn buntings, protected birds that don't move house easily. If establishing trees in open countryside brings headaches, it's nothing compared with the level of due diligence required to plant them in cities," another focus of the Trust's work. David Coughlin has spent the last 2 years at the wheel of the Trust's Urban Forest Accelerator Partnership, a Heritage Lottery-funded project to help local authorities add leaf cover to their streets and parks. He says, Trees are the largest and longest-lived organisms in the urban landscape and bring multiple benefits for people. But towns and cities can be harsh environments for them to grow. They face challenges of compacted soil, pollution, and potential vandalism. In an era of falling council budgets, we've been exploring ways to share best practice and engage communities to get trees planted in the neighbourhoods that need them most. In Lewisham, in South London, 7 years' worth of Trust seed funding has so far helped local charity Street Trees for Living, known as STFL, plant 334 saplings on busy roadsides and in school grounds. STFL plants mature trees, which are more likely to survive in their new urban homes, and which can start working hard for local residents immediately, soaking up stormwater, absorbing traffic fumes, and offering shade from debilitating city heat. The charity has established more than 3,000 trees in all, including planting at 77 schools across 6 boroughs, and STFL co-founder Marie-Claire Denier says every tree needs its own individual care plan. She says, "First, we have to study maps of public utilities to ensure our trees won't damage underground pipework and do CAT scans to find any electrical cables. That's just the start. I've got 84 separate columns of data to fill in for each sapling, detailing everything from whether it needs a stake or protective cage to its mulching, weeding, and watering regime." Little wonder each tree costs an average of £350 to become established, and each has its own volunteer guardian, a tree-loving Lewisham resident who agrees to clear rubbish from its base and keep it watered. Marie-Claire says, "Without 3 years of dedicated care, our trees would die. We're proud of our sapling success rate of over 90%, which wouldn't be possible without the 1,500-plus guardians we have on board." David Coughlin's National Trust team is talking to Marie-Claire about expanding the STFL success story further across London. Back at Wimpole Hall, meanwhile, Luke Barley and Dave Hassel are lamenting losses. Despite all their planning and care, around 10% of Wimpole's baby trees fell victim to the record-breaking summer heat waves of 2022. Luke says, "It's a higher percentage than we'd like, and ironically, it was caused by the same climate change impacts these trees are seeking to mitigate. It shows, even when you plant in the right place, it's never a sure thing. We've replanted all the lost trees, and I am not deterred. Overall, the value of these new woods will be immense. Nothing delivers so many benefits for society, whether that's carbon sequestration, better water management, increasing nature biodiversity, beautiful views, or a more tangible sense of history. We just need to continue planting the right trees in the right place."
To find out more about the Trust's plans to plant and establish 20 million trees by 2030, or to donate to our Plant a Tree appeal, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/plant-a-tree. Before we wrap up this edition, it's time to hear about some of the events going on at National Trust places this summer. Booking is essential for many of these events, and some cost a little extra, so please make sure to check individual property websites or call the property for the latest information before you visit.
The 21st of June is the time for solstice celebrations. Petworth in West Sussex is holding their Solstice Late, where you can visit after hours to enjoy the new exhibition of studies by J.M.W. Turner, then soak up the sunset in the very landscape that inspired one of the UK's most celebrated artists.
Mount Stuart in County Down is offering a solstice sound healing spa, where therapeutic sound specialist Tessa Anne will use Tibetan singing bowls, drums and rain sticks at the Temple of the Winds to help you relax.
Brownsea Island in Dorset has summer solstice yoga on offer, where you can join in with a yoga session led by Sonia Lockyer. Then tuck into a picnic dinner, followed by a meditation session. End the evening listening to nightjars chirring on the heath.
Festival of Archaeology. The UK's biggest celebration of archaeology returns from the 19th of July to the 3rd of August, organised by the Council for British Archaeology. Many trust places are hosting special festival events, including
Divis and the Black Mountain in County Antrim. On the 19th of July, celebrate the launch of this year's festival with a day of family-friendly activities. Try your hand at excavation, learn about survey techniques and discover the history of this ancient landscape.
At East Riddlesden Hall in West Yorkshire, from the 19th of July to the 3rd of August, enjoy 2 weeks of archaeological activities, demonstrations and talks, and try sandbox excavations. Young Indiana Joneses can have a go at the archaeology trail inside the hall.
At Sutton Hoo in Suffolk, from the 26th to the 27th of July, try tabletop wargaming with miniature Anglo-Saxon warriors and paint your own model to take home. On the 26th of July, volunteers will demonstrate Anglo-Saxon skills such as spinning, dyeing, and leatherwork.
And for more information on events going on during this year's Festival of Archaeology, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/festival-of-archaeology.
Below Stairs Living History. At Ickworth in Suffolk on the 27th of July, 24th of August and the 21st of September, visit the servants' quarters in the Rotunda to see costumed volunteers recreate life at Ickworth in the 1930s. You can chat to the servants about what it takes to keep the house running smoothly and their daily routines, as well as what they get up to in their spare time. The stories are all based on Ickworth's archive of memories from staff who once worked there.
Take in a show in August. At Blickling Estate in Norfolk, on the 2nd of August, celebrate 10 years of classic Ibiza with our biggest party yet, courtesy of Urban Soul Orchestra and the London Community Gospel Choir. Booking is essential. Visit the website for prices.
There's outdoor theatre at Hanbury Hall in Worcestershire in August. Be swept away by the romance of Pride and Prejudice on the 2nd of August. Witness Toad's escapades in The Wind in the Willows on the 9th of August. Enjoy Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore on the 23rd of August. Or Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor on the 30th of August. Booking is essential. Visit the website for prices.
At Erddig in Wrexham, join Chapter House Theatre as they bring Jane Austen's beloved Pride and Prejudice to life against the backdrop of Erddig's Rose Garden. Booking is essential. See the website for prices. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/outdoor-entertainment to find more outdoor events to enjoy this summer.
Heritage Open Days from the 12th to the 21st of September. Join in with Heritage Open Days, England's largest festival of history and culture.
Every year, the festival brings together thousands of individuals, communities, and local organisations to host events across the country. This year, more than 150 trust places are taking part, along with thousands of other historic sites all across the country.
Each event offers the chance to discover new stories, try out new things, and see new places, all free of charge. The theme for this year's festival is architecture, and there'll be plenty of events exploring how we've built and designed the world around us, who commissioned and constructed sites, why and how they were built, and what impact they've had on history.
You might hear from archaeologists who work to unearth the mysteries of ancient structures. Join a tour to discover the architectural influences found at a historic house, or meet some of the craftspeople keeping heritage building techniques alive. Events are still being added to our website, so keep checking back to see what's happening in your area.
Heritage Open Days is brought to you by the National Trust, with support from players of People's Postcode Lottery. Find events near you at nationaltrust.org.uk/heritage-open-days.
There's lots of adventures going on for all ages at Trust Places this summer. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/what's-on. Well, that's all from us this summer issue. I hope you've enjoyed it, and do let us know what you think of this audio edition. You can email us at magazine@nationaltrust.org.uk. The National Trust Magazine Summer 2025 was presented by me, Sally Palmer. The readers in this edition were Akia Henry, Glenn McCready and Olivia Vinnell.
It was produced for National Trust magazine by Sound Understanding. All items are copyright. CDs of this audio edition are available to visually impaired members of the National Trust and are distributed by the RNIB. If you know of anyone who is eligible and who would like to receive them, please call the RNIB on 01733 375 370. Or you can write, enclosing the membership number, to Sales and Operations, RNIB, Northminster House, Northminster, Peterborough, PE1 1YN. This audio magazine is also available to download or stream as a podcast. You can access this and previous issues free of charge from wherever you usually get your podcasts. For more information, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us for the next audio issue of National Trust magazine.